This is Central Time. I'm Rob Barrett. Coming up, what would Wisconsin look like with a flat income tax? Some Republican lawmakers are making the case for the idea. We talk to a policy expert and learn how it could change the way taxes have worked in our state for decades now. Now it's Food Friday with a focus on desserts. In her new book, our next guest has recipes for all tastes and skill levels, from super simple desserts you can whip up in 5 minutes to others that take 12 hours or more. You could join in at 800-642-1234. What is your favorite dessert to make? What is your favorite dessert to have other people make for you? Do you like to stick with simple recipes or venture into more complicated ideas? Do you tend to eat dessert at some point in the day? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. You can also post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. Clara Saffitz is a recipe developer and author. She wrote the cookbook Dessert Person. Her newest book is What's for Dessert? Simple Recipes for Dessert People. Clara, welcome to Central Time.
Thank you for having me. Pleasure to be here.
All right. Now, I like dessert, Claire, but you really like dessert, eating it and making it. What is it about dessert that's so magical?
I mean, besides the fact that I just love sweet flavors and I love, you know, all desserts of all kinds, I feel like it is, for me, a form of self-care. I just love treating myself to something sweet after dinner or even after lunch or just any time of the day. And it's just a sort of a moment for me to treat myself and give myself kind of a lovely gift. So for many different reasons, but I'm also just, I just have a sweet tooth. So that's a big part of it.
And you write that in your head, dessert equals baking. And there's a lot of baking in your book, but you also push the boundaries some. What were you, in this new book, what were you trying to expand your horizons to?
Yeah, I've always been a baker. I've always loved to bake. And so for me, that was my definition of dessert for so long. It was a cake or a cookie or something like that. But in this book, I really wanted to sort of broaden my own horizons as a dessert person. So I explore many different categories of desserts, things like chilled and frozen desserts, things like desserts you can make on the stovetop, so puddings and rice pudding and things like that. So I really tried to branch out and explore many different types of desserts. And for me, this book is a way to cater to the tastes of all different kinds of dessert people, not just myself.
And part of that is, and I love this in the book, you have sort of difficulty levels, ratings for all the recipes in the book as far as how long they take. That's pretty normal. But also just like, these ones are easy, these are less so. Why was that important to you to share with readers?
Yeah, for the most part, the difficulty level of all of the desserts in the book are on the kind of easier side. They're more to kind of one side of the spectrum, but there is still some variation. So it's really important to me as a recipe developer that the home baker understands the kind of buy-in and the commitment that they're making up front when they are attempting a recipe. So I try to be very transparent about the difficulty level to sort of give people all the information they need to know that this is a super quick and simple recipe. This one's going to take a little bit longer. You know, this one needs to chill overnight. So it's just about kind of arming the home baker with as much info as possible before they start cooking.
Now, I'm more of a cook than a baker. And you actually talk about people who have some levels of baking anxiety. They're worried that they're going to screw up this careful chemical process. Share some words of reassurance to those of us in that situation before we get rolling on one of these recipes.
Yeah, I completely understand anxiety in the kitchen, whether it's cooking or baking or both. So I try to assuage that anxiety. I tell people there's kind of psychological tips for approaching a recipe with less fear. And then there's also kind of practical ones. So I completely understand the apprehension in the kitchen. You've invested time and money and ingredients and you want it to turn out. And with baking, it's a little bit of a more mysterious process. So I tell people to do things like visualize the steps in the recipe, you know, pull out the pan that you're going to need, things like that, because just small little steps, I think, can really sort of break the seal on a recipe and make it just feel more approachable and easier to begin, because it can be a little bit overwhelming when you're just looking at all the steps on the page and all the ingredients. So I try to give little helpful tips like that throughout the book.
It is a special dessert edition of Food Friday. Claire Saffitz is with us. Her newest cookbook is called What's for Dessert? Simple Recipes for Dessert People. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Do you have a question about how to make something maybe you've encountered elsewhere? Do you have a favorite dessert that you love to make and or eat? You have a recipe that you've tried and it just didn't work out quite right? Tell us about it. 800-642-1234. 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. By the way, Claire shared a few recipes from the book with us. You can find them at WPR.org/Food Friday. Two sound great to me. One, I'll probably never eat. Okay, I can't leave that hanging, Claire. One of the recipes that some people love, grapefruit. And that's great. Uh-huh. I don't. But these bars sound super interesting. No bake grapefruit bars. Tell us a little bit about this. And there's a reason to not bake that grapefruit, it sounds like.
Yeah, I'm a grapefruit lover. We are in the middle of citrus season. So this is the time of year where we get all these beautiful citrus fruits in the market. And I love grapefruit because it has such a piercing flavor. And I love that kind of tart bitterness. But I found in all of my recipe testing that if you try to bake it, if you heat up that the juice or the segments, it really drains a lot of the flavor. So this is a perfect no-bake recipe. It's very similar to kind of a no-bake cheesecake. It has cream cheese in the filling, has lots of fresh grapefruit juice and grapefruit zest. And so it's really easy to put together. It has a kind of sturdy graham cracker crust. And you just chill the filling. So it's a kind of a fun, slightly different spin on a sort of lemon cheesecake, but great for wintertime. And I love that it has this really fresh, bright flavor. And then it's finished with segments of grapefruit on top. So you get that kind of juiciness from like the fresh fruit itself. So, you know, I think in wintertime, we struggle to find inspiration. It's like, we're not getting, you know, at least in the Northeast where I live, I'm not getting lots of, you know, beautiful produce in the market. So I turned to citrus to kind of brighten up all my desserts.
Now let's imagine a hypothetical person who liked every kind of citrus in the world except grapefruit. Could he or she substitute in other citrus for grapefruit in this recipe?
You could use any orange, I think would be great. Like Cara oranges are really special, or tangerines.
I like those.
Satsuma tangerines are so incredibly delicious and have tremendous flavor. So yeah, any other citrus that you like to eat out of hand would be great.
You can find that No Bake Grapefruit Bar at WPR.org/Food Friday. Another thing I love about the book, Claire, is that, you know, when you can get fresh fruit, great, you can use that, but you're not a snob. Frozen fruit could be fine. Instead of making your own jam for the recipe, store-bought, you are no opponent of convenience.
Not at all. I tried to, in this book, to really sort of pinpoint and hone in on particular store-bought products that were going to not only be easier, but be even better than the homemade version. So I think if the thing you could buy at the store is as good or better than what you can make at home, then I'm definitely using the store-bought version. So things like Ladyfingers or Oreo cookies that you crush up and add to a filling, jam is a great example. So certainly that's the case. And while I love cooking with fresh fruit, often frozen is even better. So if you're making a cake with blueberry or muffins, frozen blueberries tend to be even better than fresh. So I try to, that's really in an effort to provide maximum flexibility in the recipe. So I say if you can't find fresh, frozen is perfect.
And that reminds me, you give a few different levels of gear to have, like from, hey, we're going to dabble in dessert making from time to time, to we are a dessert kitchen here. What are a couple of the basics, though, that if people are going to make some desserts, you suggest having around?
Yeah, I mean, you don't need a fully outfitted kitchen with every kind of pan, you know, in your whole baking repertoire all at once. So I do give levels. And I think for kind of the casual baker or someone who's just starting out and stocking a kitchen, maybe like a recent college grad or, you know, someone in their first apartment, I say get a couple of anodized aluminum pieces of bakeware. So this is a light colored pan. They lead to really even baking. So get a 9-inch cake pan and an 8-inch square pan. These are going to be things that you use over and over and over again. A loaf pan is another one. But you don't need, you know, you don't necessarily also need a bundt pan and a 10-inch cake pan and all these different things. So I like to sort of invest in those, the most heavily used things first, and then you can kind of go from there.
Let's bring on a caller at 800-642-1234. Jacob is with us in Madison. Jacob, hi.
Yeah, hi. Since you already talked about making a substitution in lemon cheesecake and substituting out grapefruit, what I've done is when I ran out of lemons to make lemon meringue pie, I made grapefruit meringue pie, and that's really delicious.
And Jacob, I got to ask, since Claire talked about baking being bad for grapefruit, did the grapefruit bake at any point in this equation?
No, the juice is part of the, basically the pudding.
Part of the meringue, kind of.
Yeah, so it doesn't affect the flavor any more than the lemon does in a lemon meringue pie.
Excellent. Jacob, I love it. I wouldn't love the grapefruit part, but I love the idea. Clara, what do you think?
I think that's great. I have successfully made grapefruit curd, so which is similar to the filling of a citrus meringue pie. So it can definitely be done. But I've just found that, you know, fresh grapefruit and fresh citrus flavor in general works really well. But I love using sort of more unexpected citrus in place of lemon. I mean, I'm a huge lemon desserts fan as well. Mm-hmm. But I love that. I love that experimentation.
Jacob, thanks for that call at 800-642-1234. And thanks, Jacob, for the easy transition to our next recipe. He mentioned meringue. You've got meringue in a place I don't expect to find it. I love flourless chocolate cake. Well, you've got a flourless chocolate meringue cake. What's going on with that, Claire?
Yeah, this cake I love for a few different reasons. It's great because it fits a number of kind of dietary restrictions. So this cake is grain-free, gluten-free. It has almond flour in it. It's also dairy-free. So it's great to bring to like parties or gatherings or events like that if you're concerned about any kind of dietary restrictions. But typically flourless chocolate cake is lightened with beaten egg whites. So that is what is helping to give the cake its kind of lift. It doesn't have any flour in it. And in this version, I actually make more meringue than I need for the cake itself. And then I take that leftover meringue and I swirl it into the surface. And what I love about that technique is it creates this kind of crunchy, light meringue-like lid on the surface. And then it kind of gives way to this, really moist, kind of tender chocolate cake underneath. And so it creates this great textural experience. And what I love about this recipe is that you're not doing an extra step. You're just making the cake as you normally would, but just kind of thinking about it in a different way and maximizing all those different components. So you get this beautiful swirled crunchy top. So a great kind of celebration cake. People love chocolate. Great for this time of year. So that is also one of my kind of go-to entertaining recipes.
It's Food Friday. We're talking with recipe developer and author Claire Saffitz about her new cookbook. It's called What's for Dessert? Simple recipes for dessert people. Are you a dessert person? Want to hear from you at 800-642-1234. What's your favorite dessert to make? What do you like to make and or eat this time of year? Is there a dessert that you have struggled with? That's been a challenge for you. Maybe Claire could help you overcome that. Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. Find three recipes from Claire, by the way, at WPR.org/Food Friday. We'll pick up the conversation coming up here on Central Time. It's Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. We're picking up our Food Friday conversation with Claire Saffitz, recipe developer and author. Her newest cookbook is called What's for Dessert? And you can join in at 800-642-1234. What's for dessert for you tonight or this weekend? Do you have some plans for baked or other desserts? Do you have questions for our guest about how to make something? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Let's go back to your calls now. Darlene is with us in Milwaukee. Hi, Darlene.
Hi, how's it going?
Good. What did you want to bring up?
I have a love-hate relationship with cheesecakes. I love cheesecakes, but whenever I've ventured out to make one, they always end up dense or gloopy. Any suggestions on how to get on the right track with a cheesecake?
Oh, interesting, Darlene. Thanks. I like a good high-density cheesecake. Claire, but how could she lighten it up a little?
Yeah, I have actually a similar love-hate relationship because it's not so much about the making, it's more about the eating. Sometimes I find with a New York-style cheesecake where you have a ton of filling, it can just be very one note. So I like to actually decrease the amount of filling in my cheesecake so I have a little bit of a better proportion of crust to filling. So that might help to actually just sort of address some of those issues that you're having with the filling. But other than that, I would say to lighten it up, you can try increasing the number of eggs in your filling. So the more eggs, the more that filling will kind of souffle as it bakes and lighten up. You could also try adding some beaten egg whites into it. That would also sort of aerate the mixture and make it really light. But you might just try sticking with the recipe, but beating it longer with your mixer, whether that's your hand mixer or a stand mixer, to try to work some air into it. And then beyond that, it's just about kind of cooking it the right amount. So usually it's made in a water bath, which promotes really gentle cooking. And another common problem with cheesecake is cracking on the surface. and that can happen if the filling is baked either a little too much or is cooled down quickly. So you often see a tip in recipes to cool the cheesecake inside the oven with the door open. So that's another great tip, that the kind of gentle cooking and gentle cooling is really important for a successful cheesecake. But I would say, you know, as far as if it's a dense, gloopy filling, you're probably just not mixing it enough. So you want to really work some air into there. That's called mechanical leavening, and I think that should probably do the trick.
Darlene, thanks for the call. If you need somebody to help dispose of those failed cheesecakes, keep me in mind. Thanks for calling in at 800-642-1234. Karen joins us now in Reedsburg. Hi, Karen.
Hi. So my question for the marvelous dessert cooker is, I have two granddaughters that are allergic to both dairy and eggs. I'm wondering if your new cookbook offers any options for them.
Interesting. No dairy, no eggs, Claire. Any ideas for desserts?
Yeah, I have a couple of desserts in the book that are vegan. So no eggs, no dairy. It's actually easier to remove dairy than it is to remove eggs. So that can be a little bit of a challenge. But if you are looking to convert, if you already have a dairy-free recipe, for example, I have a couple of olive oil or otherwise oil-based cakes in the book. And so if you're looking to replace eggs in a recipe, a very common and useful trick is to make something called a flax egg, where you basically mix some ground flax with a little bit of boiling water, and that becomes a pretty effective egg replacement. So if you have a recipe for a loaf cake or just any other kind of cake that you like, that can be a really useful substitute. But as far as recipes in the book, I have some that are already vegan. I have a coconut rice pudding. So rice pudding is a super easy and incredibly delicious, comforting dessert. So I have one that's made with coconut milk rather than dairy milk. And it has like lychees on top, and it's infused with some tea that is... trying to remember the recipe itself, with a jasmine tea. So it's this kind of really nice vanilla-y perfumed dessert. So there's that one. So and there's lots of other resources for vegan desserts online. I really recommend the cookbook author Erin Goyaga. Her book is Cannelle Vanille.
I hope that helps you out, Karen. Thanks for calling in at 800-642-1234. It's Food Friday. Talk to Claire Saffitz. Her newest cookbook is called What's for Dessert. Back to your calls now. Charlene is on the line in Eau Claire. Charlene, hi.
Hi. You did mention that you wanted people to call in just to talk about their favorite seasonal desserts.
Yeah.
Did I hear that right?
You did.
Yeah. So there's this bread that I make, and I forget about it the whole year until Christmas rolls around. And the official name, I found it, I don't even remember where I found it, called Gift of the Magi bread. And over time, and now it's just called Maggie bread. by my family, but it's a banana bread base, and then you add maraschino cherries, chocolate chips, coconut, almond. It sounds like fruitcake, but it's delicious. It's not, you know, disgusting. And the weird ingredient is a can of mandarin oranges, and like the oranges explode in the bread and make it even moister than regular, you know, the bananas do. So, and everyone I make it for, they've never heard of it. And I guess I'd also like to ask y'all if it's maybe just a strange Midwestern thing. It might have come from some church cookbook.
Maybe.
Everybody loves it.
Charlene, yeah. Thanks. Have you run into anything like that, Claire?
I've never heard of anything like that.
Me
that
either.
Uses a banana bread base, but then adds all of these other ingredients. It almost feels like a cake version of like ambrosia. It has a kind of real mid-century sound to it, which I really love. So I'm very intrigued to try it, but it kind of sounds like a winner. So I love the sound of that recipe.
Charlene, thanks so much for sharing that with us. We've got one more recipe you shared with us, Claire, up at WPR.org/Food Friday. Now, my number one dessert to make at home is a crisp, because it's really hard to screw up a crisp. You've got a cherry and brown butter buckwheat crisp. Tell us about this a little.
I totally agree. It is hard to screw up a crisp. I mean, generally with baking and with dessert making, there's very few recipes that don't involve some kind of technique, but I really think that a crisp is as foolproof as it gets when it comes to baking. So this is a great recipe because it uses frozen cherries. You could definitely use fresh in summertime if that's what you have, but with frozen cherries, there's no pitting necessary at all. And then you just make this kind of straightforward crunchy topping using buckwheat groats, which is the whole form of the grain. And you toast them in some brown butter. You add some buckwheat flour, an egg white to help bind everything together, and some brown sugar. And it's really easy. And it has this, I love that the topping stays really buttery, but also gets crunchy. And then you have this kind of lightly sweet, slightly lemony cherry filling. So it's kind of bright and fruit forward and a great dessert you can really make any time of the year.
And does buckwheat, I mean, I assume there's some texture there. Does it give some different flavor to the crisp part of the crisp?
Yeah, buckwheat is really earthy. And when you toast the groats in brown butter, it just creates this really complex, almost minerally kind of flavor. So, you know, it just is going to contribute a lot more flavor than just plain white flour, which is why I love it. So the earthiness really plays well against the cherries.
All right, I'm going to take a wild guess here in our last minute or so that you have plans to have dessert tonight and or over the weekend. So I'll ask you, what's for dessert?
I do. Every night, this is a question that I ask unironically to my husband, you know, even though most of the time I know the answer. So actually, just last night, speaking of banana bread, I made some banana bread because I had some old overripe bananas that were not getting any younger. They were, you know, in the freezer, just taking up space. So I made a kind of improvised banana bread. I put some toasted pecans in it, some cinnamon. I had some sour cream, so I used that, and it turned out great. So that is definitely, I had it last night for dessert. I'm having it again tonight. You can't go wrong with banana bread.
You can have it for breakfast, too.
My husband had it for breakfast, exactly, any time of the day.
Claire, thanks so much for joining us today. It's been a lot of fun.
Oh, my pleasure. Thank you for having me.
That's Claire Saffitz, recipe developer and author. She wrote the cookbook Dessert Person, and she talked with us today on Food Friday about her newest book. It's called What's for Dessert? Simple Recipes for Dessert People, a baking book. You can find a few of the recipes that Claire shared with us online at WPR.org/Food Friday. That cherry and brown butter buckwheat crisp we were just talking about, no-bake grapefruit bars, and a flourless chocolate meringue cake. And you can share your favorite desserts, throw a recipe in there if you want to, online on the Ideas Network Facebook page, or let us know about your favorite desserts. You can email ideas@WPR.org. That's ideas@WPR.org. Love to hear what is going on in your kitchen in dessert land. Coming up Monday on The Morning Show with Kate Archer Kent, Wisconsin Assembly Speaker Robin Voss joins the show for a look ahead at the Republican agenda for the state legislature. It's a big budget year, setting the course for the next couple years here in Wisconsin. Join the conversation, share your questions and concerns along the way, and you can get started right now with an email, ideas@WPR.org. That's Monday morning at 7:30 here on the Ideas Network. You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network. I'm Rob Barrett. Coming up today at 6 on 1A Plus, it's the weekly roundup of news from around the world with stops in Russia, Venezuela, and the Vatican. That's today at 6 on 1A Plus. Now's discussions over what to do with Wisconsin's $6 billion budget surplus get into gear. Some Republican legislative leaders say they're working on a proposal for a flat income tax that would take advantage of that surplus. It would be a big change to the state's current progressive tax structure. They don't have to look too far for examples of states that already have a flat tax. Illinois and Michigan are two of several states that do. You can join in at 800-642-1234. What do you think of the idea? What questions do you have about how a flat tax could work in Wisconsin? We're hearing the idea the rate could be 3.5%, at least according to Senate Majority Leader Devin Lemahue. Join in with your reactions, your questions at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or email ideas@WPR.org. Jason Stein is the research director for the Wisconsin Policy Forum. Jason, welcome back to Central Time.
Thanks for having me, Rob. Good to be here.
What do we mean when we say the income tax would be a flat tax?
Well, the first thing to know is that right now in Wisconsin, we have a progressive income tax that has several brackets. And so those brackets ramp up from a 3.5% marginal tax rate for the lower income bracket up to a 7.65% tax rate in the highest bracket. And that's on income for married couples of above $374,000 a year. And so what we would do under a flat tax is we would, you know, pick some tax rate, and it could, you know, it could be anything. And that tax rate would apply to all taxable income. that people report on their income taxes. And so instead of having multiple tax rates depending on how much income you have and at what level, you just have this single tax rate.
And that's not what Wisconsin has done. And you at the forum did a study, a look back at the history of the development of Wisconsin's tax rates. Why has Wisconsin historically been a progressive income tax state?
I mean, this goes back some time. We are a, as you say, progressive income tax state. We, when you compare us to other states nationally, we are not the most progressive. In other words, we are not, the most aggressive among states nationwide in taxing wealthy earners at a higher rate than low-income earners, but we're definitely more progressive than average as a state. Now, that said, we've actually become less progressive in recent years. So, you know, when we look at what has happened in the average tax rates for people at different income levels in the state since 2008, a report that we put out last year found that, you know, people from the 40% from the top all the way up to the top 1% of earners had seen their average tax rate decline over those years, whereas the average tax rate for people at the bottom of the income scale had grown less favorable. I mean, they're still more favorable than they are for people at the upper end, you know, upper income scales. But, you know, the benefits had been, or the improvement had been for people earning middle and higher incomes, whereas people at the lower end of the spectrum had seen less favorable change. And so, you know, when we talk about making our state's progressive income tax more flat, you know, in a modest or incremental way, that has already been happening in recent years.
Talking to Jason Stein, Research Director for the Wisconsin Policy Forum, looking at the idea of changing Wisconsin's income tax system to be a flat tax. Some Republican leaders in the legislature proposing that for this budget year. Governor Evers has not looked favorably on the idea, at least not publicly so far. You can join in with your thoughts or your questions at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Let's bring on a caller now. Kathy is with us in Madison. Kathy, hi.
Well, hi. Yes, I listened to Evers' inauguration last week, and the deal is he's trying to give the middle class the more of the tax break, where the Republican side wants the break for even the rich, and that's where the tie-up is. And I'm with Evers. I mean, the middle class is just getting pulled so thin, you know, in this environment right now. So that is, I'm for that. Let's give the middle class and people lower class a break they really need right now, and
Kathy,
families.
I gotcha. Thanks a lot for the call, Kathy. Kathy spells out the political debate over tax breaks. I think a lot of consensus that there's going to be some kind of change to taxes given the budget surplus. Can you look, Jason, at what we're hearing from the Democratic governor and Republican lawmakers on this?
Sure. So obviously the forum doesn't advocate
right
for or against any specific policy, but it's factually correct that under, you know, the governor's plans and the kind of proposals that he's put forward, you'd see greater benefits for people at the lower and middle income levels than under most flat tax scenarios. And again, for, you know, if you think about it, if the upper income tax rate or the marginal tax rate for people in the income in the upper bracket is 7.7% or a little under that, and then you lower the tax rate to 3.5% or something in a flat tax, that's going to be a big drop of more than 4 percentage points on that income in what is currently our upper tax bracket. For somebody who only has income in the lowest tax bracket, there's almost going to be no change at all because the current tax rate is 3.54%. So that's kind of how it works. I mean, one thing I will say is there's not just one flat tax proposal. I mean, there can be many. So it does make some difference in, you know, what is the standard deduction or the deduction for, you know, the tax filer and for any dependents that they might have, you know, what if, are there tax credits that would go to, you know, the working poor or for low-income people for their property taxes paid or to veterans. So there are things that could make a flat tax more progressive or less progressive depending on how you structure it. But it's certainly fair, I think, to say that in general, any kind of a flat tax proposal that was passed would be, you know, less progressive than our current system and would probably deliver more benefits to people at the upper end of the income scale.
Kathy, thanks for calling in. We're talking to Jason Stein, Research Director for the Wisconsin Policy Forum. We're learning about the idea of a flat income tax, how it could work, how it could affect taxpayers in Wisconsin. Some Republican legislative leaders calling for it as we start to negotiate a new two-year budget for Wisconsin. You can join in at 800-642-1234. What questions do you have about the idea? Do you like it? Do you want to see this kind of change or not? If you live in one of our neighboring states, in Illinois or in Michigan, with that flat income tax, what do you think? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. We'll continue the conversation coming up here on Central Time. It's Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. We're picking up our conversation with Jason Stein, Research Director for the Wisconsin Policy Forum, talking about what a flat income tax is, what it could look like as it's come up as an idea from some Republicans, especially in the state Senate. You can join in at 800-642-1234 with your thoughts on the idea, your questions. That's 800-642-1234. Let's go back to your calls. Peter is with us in Madison. Peter, hi.
Hello. Thanks for taking my call. My thought is if you had a flat tax of like, you know, I think you guys threw out 3.5, would it make at least a little difference if you had a minimum then that you didn't tax? For example, if you said the first $20,000 is not taxed, and then you start doing the 3.5%, then those in the lower income bracket would still not lose as much because their first $20,000 or whatever number is picked, they're not paying any tax at all.
I gotcha, Peter. And Jason, you were starting to touch on that. It depends on how you define the flat tax rule, things like personal exemptions. What are your thoughts for Peter?
Yeah, no, that's absolutely possible. I mean, obviously right now we have a in Wisconsin, we have a standard deduction that is applied to your adjusted gross income, and that lowers the amount of taxable income that you apply the tax rate and brackets to. And so you absolutely could have that. You know, in Wisconsin right now, the standard deduction phases out as the income of the tax filer grows. But you can also have you know, earned income tax credits that are applied or other tax credits, you know, a child tax credit that's applied, you know, after tax due is calculated. So there are a lot of things that can be done. I mean, I think one thing that you sometimes hear policymakers say is they'll say, well, you know, on both sides of the aisle, they'll say, well, we had to do this income tax proposal this way or that way, because, you know, we really don't have many options. And the reality is with the income tax system, they're not, the options are not infinite, and there some things are a good idea and some things are a bad idea, but there's a lot of flexibility and authority that the state has to structure its income tax. And so, you know, they can arrive at a lot of different outcomes by a lot of different means. So, you know, it's good for your listeners to understand that, you know, policymakers, their hands are not tied. They have a lot of freedom to move and maneuver and change the system that we have if they choose to do that.
Peter, thanks for that call. Matt joins us now in Mequon. Matt, hello.
Hi, I'm calling. I have a general comment that the purpose of a progressive tax code is to put the tax burden on the people that benefit most from the infrastructure of the community, the state, the country. They are the ones that are benefiting most from law enforcement, electric grids, public schooling, things like that. And so it's designed to make them pay for that, but they don't want to pay for that. So I guess my question to these lawmakers who are probably being lobbied by their wealthy donors is, when you go to a flat tax, how are you going to pay for all these things? I don't want Wisconsin to end up like Kansas.
Matt, thanks for the call. Let's tackle that second point first. Jason, if depending on how these are designed, this could be a significant tax cut overall. Does that make us worried about the revenue needed to do the infrastructure stuff that Matt's talking about?
Sure. So, I mean, that is absolutely something to think about. You know, right now, the break even point for a revenue neutral flat tax is about 5.2%, the tax rate. You know, that would be, you know, a tax increase for people at the, you know, or for income at the lower parts of the current brackets. And so that, you know, then you start to talk about as well, if you want to lower that further, would you have to, say, increase the state sales tax or something like that, which would itself be a regressive move? Right now, if you look at Wisconsin's income tax, it ranks about 12th or 13th highest nationally in terms of the taxes collected as a share of personal income in states, in Wisconsin and other states. So our income tax is relatively high in Wisconsin. On the other hand, our state sales tax and local sales taxes are relatively low, below the national average. So, you know, a lot of times when we're talking about, you know, any one tax like the income tax or the property tax, we get very fixated on that. But really what we're really should be thinking about when we talk about taxes is the overall tax system that we have in the state and sort of the overall pros and cons of it.
Thanks for that call. Time for one more caller. Steve is on the line calling from Illinois. Steve, hello.
Hi. Yes, I'm a resident of Illinois, and we have a flat tax, as you know, 4.95%. I would caution Wisconsin residents to watch out for a flat tax. In Illinois, it's resulted in low state revenues, and the state does not fund local efforts like schools, law enforcement, and many other things, which means we have one of the highest property tax rates in the country, and that's regressive.
Steve, so, thanks for the call. We don't have too much time left. Jason, are there lessons we might want to try to learn, at least from Illinois and other states, with that state flat income tax?
Well, I think, you know, you talk about why do you want a flat tax or what are the pros and cons? You know, for the proponents of a flat tax, they say that as people's income grows, a flat tax does not provide a disincentive for them, you know, to work more, earn more, be more productive. And I think, you know, there's some obvious truth to that. At the same time, the revenue that an income tax generates can also be used to fund education. It can be used to fund infrastructure and other services. And those may also make workers and our overall economy more productive. And they may be, if people feel that they're, you know, people at the lower end may also be more incentivized to work and study and learn because they feel like there's a path for them to better themselves in part through using public services. So I think, you know, we really have to think about both sides of the equation, both the public cost and the public investment of an income tax and our overall system when we think about, you know, what is going to give us the kind of society that we want and will benefit most from.
Thanks for that call. And Jason, we'll leave it there. Thanks again for joining us today.
Oh, it's my pleasure. Anytime.
That's Jason Stein, Research Director at the Wisconsin Policy Forum. We talked to him today about what a flat income tax is, how it could look if applied to Wisconsin's tax structure. Now it's time for Wisconsin Life. Here's producer Maureen McCollum with a story about a resilient group of dancers.
The Milwaukee Dancing Grannies are a staple in southern Wisconsin's parade scene. With their matching outfits and dance routines, they bring joy and inspiration to people, even after an unthinkable tragedy. Christina Leffring brings us their story.
The day of Muskego's Christmas parade has been cold, rainy, and pretty gloomy. Yet Main Street in this small city in Waukesha County is lined with grandparents, parents, and of course kids, waiting for the parade. Especially the Milwaukee Dancing Grannies. For almost 40 years, the troop of grandmothers dancing and waving pom-poms in formation have been a highlight of holiday parades across eastern Wisconsin. But last year, three members and one member's husband were killed when Daryl Brooks drove his vehicle through the Waukesha Christmas Parade. The Grannies have always been a fan favorite, but in light of last year's tragedy, crowds have celebrated their return with standing ovations.
I think everybody on the entire street was standing and clapping. So it was a bit emotional, and it was really wonderful to see.
It actually makes me cry every time I see them, just with everything that happened. And they're so cute, and it just breaks my heart still. And it brings me joy to see them at all the parades.
They're fantastic. We love them every time. I want to be a dancing granny someday.
It's really a lot harder than it looks.
That's Doreen Lopez, who joined just last January.
Well, it's not for the faint of heart. It's a lot of work. It's a big commitment.
Dancing grannies rehearse at least once a week. Each member is expected to perform in at least two-thirds of the parades the group is scheduled for, which in the winter could mean two or three parades in one weekend.
You think, you know, you're going to the practices, it's time-consuming, it's hard, and then you do a parade and you think, worth it.
That's Janet Pauly, another new member. Pauly and Lopez were two of several new grannies who joined in January. After the Waukesha attack, the group decided to hold auditions to strengthen their membership.
I knew that when I started, you realize how time-consuming it is, and I thought, I'll try it a year, and I think we're all in it for the long haul.
A few veteran grannies also danced in Muskego. Janice Kramer has been a granny for 19 years. This past year was particularly hard for her. She knew two of the women killed in Waukesha personally and had a series of deaths in her family shortly after, including her husband. But she's still dancing.
So this kind of helps me get through that. It gives me, you know, I can make it. I can make it. I'm not going to be sitting home in a fetal position somewhere in a corner.
One silver lining is more people have learned about the group, like Kramer's neighbor, who saw her leave the house in the granny's royal blue winter uniform, trimmed with white fur and a fur hat.
He rolled the window down. He said, "Are you really a dancing granny?" I said, "Yes, I am. You know, I don't dress like this for nothing."
She's struggling to keep up physically, but she's still motivated by the camaraderie.
All the girls were so great, just like these new ones are, just fantastic women. I was thinking I might have to retire because I'm getting older and stuff, but these girls are so much fun. I think I have to stick around maybe for a while longer.
Plus, there are the crowds.
Have you ever walked in a parade? Oh my God, you should do that because we're old ladies and you get wolf whistles out there. I mean, I'm 75. How many more years am I going to have somebody doing a wolf whistle to us, you know? That's incentive enough.
The group says they've gotten a lot of messages from people who want to join and who can blame them. The group will announce plans for expanding and auditions after their members take a well-deserved break to rest and recuperate.
Christina Laffering brought us that story on the Milwaukee Dancing Grannies. Wisconsin Life is a co-production of Wisconsin Public Radio and PBS Wisconsin in partnership with Wisconsin Humanities. Additional support comes from Lowell and Mary Peterson of Appleton. Find more Wisconsin Life at wisconsinlife.org and on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram. I'm Maureen McCollum.
Coming up Monday here on Central Time, the Biden administration announced restrictions on asylum seekers coming to the U.S. from selected countries, and the president is scheduled to visit the southern border over the weekend. We'll get the latest on border security and immigration. Plus, a commonly used password security application had a data breach over the last few weeks. So what are we supposed to do to have good passwords and protect all of our online information? A cybersecurity expert joins the show with some advice. Plus, a lot of states around the country saw minimum wage increases with the beginning of the new year. We'll find out what's going on and what difference it might make. That's all coming up Monday here on Central Time.